Okay. The last week was a kind of introduction. Today we get down to serious business. This next block of the course is on the American economy. And in the spirit of the class as a whole, what we will do is examine how American economic institutions work, try to see what values they are meant to accomplish, and then evaluate them in terms of how well they actually live up to the values which they proclaim. Throughout the semester, we're going to be constantly interrogating institutions in terms of the values we hope our institutions help us realize. So just to remind you, there are five general values which I laid out in the first lecture that will animate this discussion. They are freedom, prosperity, efficiency, fairness or equality, and democracy. These are five values. Each of them is subject to lots of debate as to exactly what they mean. And we will bring those debates to bear on some of these discussions. These are values, they can be thought of as critical values because they enable you to criticize and hopefully improve the way institutions work. So in this first block of the course, we're going to look at the problem of democracy, of the economy, and how it really works. In the last lecture, when I very quickly explored the question, what kind of country is this? A number of the elements did bear on the character of our economic institutions. I mentioned technology. That's one of the ways you can ask, what kind of a country is this? And another is the nature of its economic institutions. And here is where the question of the market and capitalism really come into play. So, let me begin by giving you what the overall argument of this whole section of the course. So this is the kind of master argument that will carry us through the beginning of October. The overall argument of the course. Markets are a desirable feature of complex economies for two basic reasons. We're going to be studying markets and how they work, and particularly how capitalist markets work. And there are two ways in which I will argue they are desirable. First, markets can contribute in significant ways to efficiency and prosperity. And second, market exchanges can contribute to individual freedom. So you see a couple of our values are in play right from the start. Markets can contribute to freedom and they can contribute to efficiency and prosperity. However, and this is a very big however, it's not an asterisk that you put to just say there's a wrinkle. However, the unregulated free market with minimal government intervention ends up deeply limiting individual freedom, restricting prosperity, and undermining efficiency. Now, this is a pretty interesting kind of argument. You have something which has positive effects, markets, on a number of bases, freedom, prosperity, efficiency, these are all good things. But those effects are themselves dependent upon adequate regulation of those markets. Unregulated markets don't produce these positive effects. You need markets, but you need markets that are somehow constrained and not acting as free and unfettered markets. And the conclusion then is what we really need are democratically accountable market institutions. The democratic accountability part is a claim about the way the economy works. It's not just a claim about the value of democracy per se. We'll get to that later in the course, why democracy itself is a value. Here it's saying that our economic institutions will not work very well. They'll be filled with imperfections unless they're properly regulated, and the only way to regulate them in a way that serves our collective interests is for them to be democratically accountable. Now, there's a lot of complexity in all of that. I'm going to try to build this argument step by step, Some of this will be pretty challenging, but I hope by the end of the process it will all be clear. Well, first step then. We have to return to a question which I just very briefly touched on in the last lecture. What is capitalism? The strategy here is to first define the character of the economic institutions in which we live, and then begin to examine how they actually work. So the first point, which I also mentioned in the last lecture, is that capitalism is only one of the very many ways that an economy can be organized. We all pretty much take it for granted that we live in a capitalist economy. I don't imagine that many of you give it a whole lot of thought. When you go into a grocery store and find a vast array of food on the shelves, and you pick what you want, and you go to the cash register, and you engage in a peculiar kind of transaction, giving money to one person and taking the food with you, what you have done is engaged in a market transaction. But that's not the only way that people acquire food in the world, even today. And certainly historically, this is an extremely peculiar way that people acquire food. Throughout most of human history, people acquired food, a key part of their economic life, by producing it or gathering it themselves. Now, that's not capitalism. It's not capitalism if the main way you get food is by producing it for yourself. That's a different kind of economic structure. In American history, when a century or two centuries ago, the United States wasn't really a fully capitalist economy. A very substantial part of production in the United States 200 years ago was people producing for themselves, not for the market. Small farmers produced most of the things they produced were for their own consumption, and only when they had a surplus did they send it to market. Furthermore, in the United States, until 1865, of course, a substantial part of our economy was organized on the basis of slavery. That isn't a small detail in American history. It's part of the foundation of our society, our economy, our history. Is that we had an economy that was based on slavery. Slavery is not capitalism. It's true that slave production produced things that were sold on a market, so it was a market economy, but it wasn't a capitalist market economy. There was not a labor market. Labor wasn't acquired by people looking for a job. Labor was acquired by buying people. Totally different kind of economic structure. So this is the first thing to just constantly keep in mind. You know, in a course like this, there are a number of big ideas. Some of them are totally simple-minded. I mean, once you think about it, of course, it's obvious. But it's easy to forget the obvious sometimes. And here's one of the key big ideas. The world is filled with variation. What we take for granted is not the only way things are or could be. And the nature of our economy is one of the key issues around big variations in the world. That's the first point. Now let me give you the definition again. I gave this last time. I'll go over this definition a bunch of times. Like many concepts, the real point of this definition only becomes clear as you use the ideas in different kinds of contexts. Capitalism is not just a free market society. When you hear people create an equivalence between markets and capitalism, that's wrong. They've made a mistake. Capitalism is not just a free market society. It is a market society with two other critical elements. The means of production are privately owned. They're not owned by the state. They're not owned by municipalities. They're not owned by the workers who use those means of production. In a capitalist economy, capital, that is the resources, the means of production, the inputs to production, are owned by private individuals as private property. And secondly, The labor that is used in production is obtained through voluntary market exchange, or what we call the labor market. People look for jobs and are hired, and that's how the means of production and the people who use those means of production get combined. Now, it's a general property of any economic system. This applies from ancient times to the present, that there's always some kind of means of production, the things people use to produce, and there's labor, people using those means of production, whether it be simple tools or complex machines, or whether it be in an office where the means of production are, in effect, buildings and communications technology. There are always means of production and people who use them. And the way different economic systems vary is exactly who controls which of these and how they get combined. In a capitalist economy, the means of production are privately owned, and they get combined with the people who will use them through a labor market. The American economy is generally called a capitalist economy for good reason, but it is not a pure capitalist economy. Indeed, there never has been, and I would argue there never could be, a purely capitalist economy. All economies within which capitalism is the dominant way that economic activity is organized, all such economies contain lots and lots of non-capitalist elements. Many different ways in which things are produced besides the conventional capitalist way. Just to give you the very simplest of examples, in the American economy, most people prepare at least some of their meals in their own home. In a purely capitalist economy, everyone would always eat in restaurants. You would never prepare food for yourself, because if you're preparing food for yourself, that's kind of like what farmers used to do. You got the inputs from the market, but then you transform those inputs into the actual food that satisfies your needs. You do that not for exchange, not for the market. You're just doing it for your own consumption. The work you do in a kitchen is a production process. You have means of production, a stove, a skillet. You have labor. It takes some skill, some activity to transform. Even if you're just doing a microwave dinner, it takes some activity to transform the raw materials into food. So at a very minimum, it's clear we have a significant amount of activity that is economic in character, transforming inputs into outputs for purposes of satisfying needs. That takes place just in the privacy of your own home, and that's non-capitalist. But there's many other kinds of non-capitalist production. One of my non-capitalist economic relations in American society, one of my favorite examples, and I think this is in the book as well, is to draw a contrast between bookstores and libraries. Bookstores and libraries. So books are an economic product. They're something people consume. They satisfy various kinds of needs. There are many ways that people get connected to books. So if you want a book, there's many different ways you can get access to a book. Two important ways are bookstores and libraries. And these are absolutely fundamentally different kinds of social structures. In a bookstore, you go into the store, go to the shelf, find the book that you were looking for, check its price, check your pocket and see how much money you have and what your budget is, and if you can afford it and still want it, you buy it, and if it turns out to be too expensive, you put it back on the shelf. So your ability to get access to a book in a bookstore depends upon your ability to pay, how much money you have. Look for the exact same book in a library. You go to the shelf or ask the librarian to check to see if it's available. If it's available, you check it out. It would be completely crazy. I mean, imagine somebody who would only check out really expensive books from libraries because they were such a bargain. Right? So if you check out really expensive books, it doesn't cost you anything and it would sell for a lot, so you're saving the most money. That's not how you use a library. You check out books because they're the books you want to read. It's unmediated by the price. It doesn't play any role in your decision as to whether or not you want to check out a book. Libraries and bookstores are very different kinds of institutions, and the United States has both of them. It's a kind of irony, in fact, in the United States. I don't know how many of you know the history of American libraries, but the very strong public library system which we have in the United States was founded by Andrew Carnegie at the end of the 19th century, who donated millions of dollars to communities all over the United States to build libraries. Carnegie had a belief that, in spite of the fact that he was this great robber baron magnate, great capitalist magnate in the 19th century, he had this very strong belief that a person's wealth should not govern their access to information, to books in those days. And so he donated millions of dollars to build what is one of the best public library systems in the world. In many American communities, very conservative people who don't like government love their public libraries. They don't really recognize the fact that the library is really a fundamentally anti-capitalist system. It's not just non-capitalist. It says things should be free to people just on the basis of their needs. That's not the capitalist principle for how people get their needs met. Your needs get met by your ability to pay, not by the importance of the needs themselves in a capitalist market economy. One could imagine a library system being greatly expanded and that libraries could provide for all sorts of things besides books, and indeed, many libraries do. Many libraries provide videos. The Madison Libraries, public libraries, you can check out paintings and put on your wall. So you can have, great reproductions of classic paintings nicely framed and put them on your wall for a month and then bring them back and get a different painting. So you can look at a Rembrandt for a month and a Van Gogh the next month. You can check out paintings. And there are many other kinds of non-capitalist institutions in the American economy as well. Worker cooperatives. Madison has a number of really vibrant worker-owned firms. There's no private owners. The owners are the workers themselves. Union Taxi, the yellow cabs that you see around, that's a worker-owned cooperative. There's a coffee roaster in Madison called Just Coffee. Extremely interesting and vibrant worker cooperative. There's an advanced manufacturing engineering cooperative, Isthmus Engineering. Which is very successful. It produces industrial robots. And it's a worker-owned firm in which the machinists and the engineers and the receptionists are all equal owners of the firm. One person, one vote controls what happens in that firm. And it's extremely successful. Those are non-capitalist firms still functioning in a market economy. And I could go on. Anybody here from North Dakota, by any chance? North Dakota has a state-run bank. It's one of the, I think it's the only state-run bank in the United States. It's a bank that's owned by the state government, and it provides loans to local businesses on favorable rates. In spite of the fact that North Dakota is a pretty conservative state, it has this socialist bank, essentially. The state runs this bank because it's seen as advantageous for the local economy, which it indeed is. So the fact is, then, that although I'm going to be emphasizing that the American economy is a capitalist economy, it's always important to remember that it isn't only a capitalist economy. And one of the things we should think about once we get into the heart of the discussion of how the American economy works and what some of its problems are, one of the things we should think about is whether some of these non-capitalist elements should be strengthened. One way that we might improve the functioning of our economy is by shifting the balance, particularly for some sectors, between the amount of economic activity that's organized in this purely capitalist way and the kinds of economic activities which might be organized in various types of non-capitalist ways. It could be, I mean, this is one way of thinking about it, that the virtues of the capitalist component are enhanced when they're reduced rather than when they're dominant. That when you have too much capitalism, when capitalism organizes too many aspects of life, then it's harder to regulate in a way that makes the market serve our interests with respect to freedom, prosperity, and efficiency. These are themes that we will come to when we discuss more specific economic contexts in the course of the next several weeks. All of this also raises some important moral questions. Are there aspects of our needs, things which we produce, which you think should not be produced for the market, should not be organized in a capitalist way? Are there categories of things which we consume, which you feel in principle should be somehow insulated from the market? What do you think? Can you think of examples? Yeah. Weapons. Okay, that's interesting. Should weapons be produced for sale on a market? Or should we only have certain kinds of weapons produced? Most people, I think, would say that small nuclear bombs should not be made freely available on a market. We shouldn't have a kind of free market in that kind of weapon. Most Americans think that we should have a free market in handguns. Small arms that people have, people should be able to freely buy. Some people feel that they should be bought, but with restrictions. Other people feel there should be no restrictions at all. Think of some other things. Education. So should education be something which you can buy on the market, or should it be entirely produced through non-market mechanisms, like the University of Wisconsin is a non-market provision. It's a state institution that hires faculty and other people to produce education. But it's not privately owned, and it's not trying to maximize profits in the course of its services. So education, is it something which in principle should only be done publicly or privately? Or is this just a practical matter? We should just see which works best. Some people would say for education, it's just a practical matter. It's an empirical question. If it can be done better privately, it should be done privately. If it can be done better publicly, it should be done publicly. But there wouldn't be any moral principle involved. Think of issues. What is something that you would not want to see sold on a market, regardless of its efficiency? Yeah. Healthcare. Well, healthcare, I think the efficiency issues would have to be a part of it still. I mean, I think we'll have a whole section on healthcare, and you'll see, I think there's very big issues around the problem of having a pure market for healthcare. But it still would be somewhat of a pragmatic issue. Maybe a mix would be the best. Yes, here and there. Yeah, that's body parts. Should we have a free market in kidneys? Well, in some parts of the world, you can go and buy a kidney. If you need a kidney, if you're having kidney failure, there are places in the world you can go and basically buy a kidney. And there's people who want to sell one of their kidneys. In the United States, that's illegal. In the United States, kidneys are rationed. There's a list of people who need them, and then there are donors. Usually, they're not live donors, but there are people who want to voluntarily give a kidney, but it's still given in a non-market basis. You can't sell it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. prostitution. Okay, that's a really interesting case because I think there is a there certainly is a lively debate. Most people, I think, believe on moral grounds that prostitution, having a free market in sex, is wrong, even if it's efficient. It's hard to argue it isn't efficient. I mean, it's clearly efficient because there is a supply and a demand. What efficiency means in the market is, if you have a transaction, does it make both parties better off than if you don't have the transaction? It's an improvement of efficiency if you allow a trade to occur that makes both parties better off. Well, prostitution certainly seems to satisfy that. I mean, you might want it regulated to avoid children being involved or having it be a disguised form of sexual slavery. You know, there's all sorts of regulative things. But on efficiency grounds, I think prostitution passes the test. Yet, there are grounds on which we would want to say, no, we don't want this aspect of human life to be turned into something which is purely instrumental, bought and sold on a market. It somehow undermines the values which we care about. And therefore, we're going to block the freedom of people to engage in that market transaction. So prostitution is a good one to think about. The moral issues cut against a very important moral value of the market, freedom. So freedom is the moral value of the market. People should be able to trade whatever they want. Efficiency is a value of the market. If people want to trade, they're better off if they can trade. And yet, here is a case where at least many people will feel very hesitant that somehow allowing that market to exist is going to undermine other really important values that we care about. One more example, yeah. Well, we're going to spend a lot of time on transportation. It's hard to imagine how you could have a market economy without some aspects of transportation being bought and sold. So transportation certainly seems the efficiency gains of allowing people to buy and sell means of transportation seem pretty big. Yet transportation may be an area where, for pragmatic reasons, we feel there should be a significant component of transportation which is organized outside of the market. And that's something we'll discuss in a week. Let me give one other example. There are economists who argue that there should be a market in babies because there are couples that find it difficult to get to adopt a child, and there are poor people whose lives would be improved if they could produce what they produce well with their limited means of production. Namely, they could produce babies. So there's this argument that we should have a global market in babies where you have people who produce babies and then they get very well paid. You know, so it's a real market. You get paid a lot. Their standards of living would go up. This would improve the lives of their own children. And it would improve the lives of rich people in the northern hemisphere who want to buy children. It wouldn't be slavery, although it's a purchase of a person, because full human rights would be accorded to the baby. The baby would have full citizenship rights, et cetera, et cetera. So you're not selling a child into bondage. You're just engaged in a market transaction which improves the lives of the poor and improves the lives of the rich. So it's clearly efficient. Most people find it pretty disturbing. And it's worth really taking seriously why you find it disturbing. Really, you know, think about it. I find it disturbing. If I was a hardcore, you know, radical libertarian, I would say, what's the big deal? Calm down, you know. This improves everybody's life. Don't worry about it. If people want it, if there's a buyer and a seller, let them do it. Most people find that pretty disturbing, and I think for good reason. But the reason has to do with the way in which other values besides efficiency enter into our judgments about economic relations. And that's why you just absolutely should never buy in, whatever else you get out of this course. One thing is, don't buy into the illusion that the only thing that matters in economic life is efficiency. That's simply false. It's so obviously not true that anybody actually says it's true is quite remarkable to me. There are many values we deeply care about which are in play in economic life, and those values have to be given weight when we assess any economic question, including the one we're talking about right now, what should or should not be allowed to be bought and sold on a market. Okay, let me now turn to the main subject of today's lecture, arguments in defense of capitalist markets. There are two primary arguments in defense of capitalist market. The first is a moral argument. Capitalist markets promote freedom. And the second is what I will call a pragmatic argument. Capitalist markets promote efficiency and prosperity. Freedom, efficiency, and prosperity are the biggies. These are the values that are in play around the market, around capitalism. The moral argument says capitalism promotes freedom and therefore it's a good thing. And that's independent of whether it promotes efficiency or prosperity. It's a good thing just because it promotes freedom. The pragmatic argument says we want capitalism and we want capitalist markets because we will all be more prosperous and we will have a more efficient way of organizing the economy than in any alternative. So first, the moral argument. It's pretty straightforward. I think it's probably familiar to most of you. Markets promote individual freedom since in a free market, all transactions are the result of voluntary agreements. No one is forced to do anything. And that's a central component of the idea of freedom. That is, you get to make choices, not somebody else making choices for you. Capitalism promotes freedom because at its core is the notion of voluntary agreement. Two parties coming together and mutually agreeing on something. It's a very simple idea. And certainly it's the case that if you value freedom in that sense, if you value the ability of people to make voluntary choices and agreements, then this is an argument in favor of markets. Markets allow people to do this. But note, and this will become a very important point in some of our subsequent discussions, the concept of freedom in this definition is a quite limited one. It's what is sometimes referred to as negative freedom. Negative freedom. You can think of freedom, and this is a kind of first cut into the problem, you can think of the idea of freedom as having a negative and a positive face. You can think of negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from coercion. You have negative freedom if nobody tells you what to do. You're free from the coercion of others. That's negative freedom. Positive freedom is the actual capacity to do things that you want to do. Positive freedoms mean you have the real capacity to actually act in the world according to your purposes and plans. Negative freedom simply means nobody else has the right to tell you what to do. Negative freedom means no one tells you, no one can force you to do something without your consent. So both you and Ted Turner have the same freedom of speech, even though Ted Turner owns hundreds of television stations and you own none. Balzac once said that both rich and poor are free to sleep under bridges. Because nobody says you can't sleep under bridges. I guess nowadays people say you can't sleep under bridges, but when he wrote, that was the case. Markets are good because when a buyer and a seller agree to something, this is a voluntary exchange without coercion. Positive freedom is a much more demanding idea. In positive freedom, you are the master of your own life. You are in actual control of your life plans. But that means you have to have access to resources. You can't put your life plans into place if you're desperately impoverished. So positive freedom adds to negative freedom the requirement that people have access to resources. And you can see why there's a tension between these. There's a big tension between these. Markets allow negative freedom. Markets don't in any way guarantee anything about positive freedom. People can starve under markets, within markets, but nobody is forcing them to starve. That is, there's nobody saying, you must starve. They're starving because they don't have access to resources. Their positive freedom is denied by markets, but not their negative freedom. We will be exploring a lot around that theme when we get to the middle part of the course and we discuss questions of inequality and fairness and how freedom bears on those kinds of issues as well. The pragmatic argument centers around the a really complicated problem in which markets are thought to provide a crucial solution. The central problem that needs a solution is how do we organize cooperation and coordination in conditions of high levels of complexity. Here's an example I think I give in the book. So let's suppose you want to build a house in Madison. You need lumber, nails, wire, ceramic tiles, carpets, windows. You need all sorts of things in order to build your house. Each of these are inputs into your house building. And each of these were produced with machines and energy and many kinds of raw materials from all over the world, involving tens of thousands of people engaged in laboring activity. This is unbelievably complex. I mean, the simple act of building something in Madison involves you engaged in cooperation and coordination with people in Brazil, in Africa, in Europe, in Australia, all over the world. There will be people cooperating with you to enable you to build your house. You know, it's just, if you really reflect upon the complexity involved in everything you do and the complexity of the cooperation and coordination. Cooperation and coordination meaning that if all those people didn't do those things, you couldn't do what you want to do. That you have to somehow coordinate your needs to buy nails, to buy lumber, to buy ceramic tiles, or whatever. You have to somehow or other figure out how to coordinate all that with what people all around the world are doing who you'll never meet, who've never even heard of Madison. It's unbelievably complex to imagine how you can get even moderately adequate coordination and cooperation under that degree of complexity. There are two basic solutions to this problem. You know, there are nuances. I'm giving you the kind of first cut story. One way that you could organize cooperation on a large scale is through planning and command. You could have a central authority which tries to figure out how much lumber, how many nails, how much ceramic, how many carpets, et cetera, are needed in a given period of time. Could look around all the possible places where these could be produced and give instructions to people. You produce that many nails, you produce that much lumber, you produce that many windows. So it could all be done by a central authority giving commands and instructions, planning how much of everything should be produced so that you, when you want to build your house, can get all of these supplies. Well, that is an impossibly complex problem to be solved by that vision of planning and command. The old planning models of the Soviet Union and of China until the 1980s had a vision in which it was thought that economic activity could be planned in advance in this kind of comprehensive way. And that just proved impossible. You don't have to assume bad faith or that the actors involved were simply out for their own power to understand why that effort simply couldn't succeed. It was too complex, even with computers. I mean, some people think that with modern computers these things would become easy. No, it wouldn't. It's too complicated to comprehensively plan all the inputs needed for any kind of economic activity. The other solution is markets. Markets and voluntary exchange are the alternative way by which this is solved. How do markets solve this problem? Well, the usual way of thinking about this, at some point people invoke one of the earliest descriptions of how this happens. It's Adam Smith's famous idea of the invisible hand. I imagine that many of you have heard that expression, the invisible hand of the market. I don't usually in lectures give quotes, but it's worth, I think, just seeing what Adam Smith wrote about the market in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations. An individual who intends only his own gain is led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interests, he frequently promotes that of society more effectively than when he really intends to promote it. That's the idea of the invisible hand. Well, how does this really work? I mean, that's a kind of flowery statement. What are the mechanisms? What's the real process by which this occurs? The key mechanisms that do the solving revolve around the notions of supply and demand and prices. Supply and demand and the notion of price. The idea of a price is really crucial here. So we're now getting into the mechanics of how a market is supposed to solve this problem of coordination and cooperation under conditions of huge complexity. The idea of price is really important. Prices are pretty weird if you, like many things that you take for granted, if you really try to ponder what it means, things get pretty weird very quickly. You take two things which have nothing in common, you know, an apple and a hammer. And a number gets assigned to each, which tells you how many apples are worth the same as one hammer. 10 apples equals one hammer. That's a pretty weird idea, right? That 10 apples are in some sense the same as one hammer. Obviously, 10 apples are not the same as one hammer in terms of any use that they have. But they are the same as one hammer because they have the same value. They are worth the same in terms of price, in terms of money. And that's what money enables people to do. It enables them to make equivalence across things which are extremely qualitatively different. And therefore, they can trade. If somebody has a hammer and somebody has 10 apples, in effect, they can trade the two, knowing that they are of the same value because they have the same price. Of course, that's not how it actually happens. People don't usually trade hammers for apples. They sell apples and buy hammers. And that's what money enables people to do. Well, how does this actually get around to coordinating the economy? So remember, the whole point of this is to solve this difficult problem, which markets solve better than command and planning. That is, it solves the problem of coordination and cooperation under conditions of complexity. So here's the standard story. If not enough of something is produced, so if people want something and there's not enough of it around, then the price will rise because people who want this thing will bid it up. So if there's a scarcity of some product and people want it, they're going to be willing to pay more. They're going to push the price up. Pushing the price up creates an incentive for producers to produce more. They produce more, and so prices fall. That's the standard story of supply and demand. The demand is people wanting something. The supply are producers producing something. So you begin this conventional story with there not being enough of something that's produced. The people who demand it scramble and bid it up. It gets to be more expensive, and suddenly it becomes very profitable to produce this thing because your costs of producing it haven't changed, but suddenly you can sell it for more. So more people start producing it, and as a result, the prices fall. Coordination occurs through information and incentives generated by prices. Information and incentives. Prices are provide information to producers, and it provides incentives for them to produce. Eventually, no one is willing to produce more at the ongoing price, which means that the price of the thing must be pretty close to what it costs to produce it. This is called an equilibrium. That's a nice bit of technical language that you'll encounter a lot if any of you venture into the thickets of economics. This is called an equilibrium. It's a situation where the price and quantity remain stable because no one has an incentive to change their behavior. No consumers want to buy more of the thing in question, and no producers have any incentive to want to produce more. The importance of the problem of coordination and how extraordinary it is that a coordination occurs in a complex society of autonomously acting individuals is really, you really can't overstate just how amazing it is. If you go to a store and buy a candy bar, right, you're hungry after this class, you go and you buy a Snickers. What happens? You buy it, you're giving information to the store owner. Little bit of information about the demand for that candy. The information from the store owner gets translated through orders for chocolate bars to the chocolate factory owner. That information goes to the cocoa importer. That information goes to the peasant in Colombia or in West Africa making the coffee beans, growing the coffee beans. When you buy a candy bar at a store in Madison, you are communicating with a peasant in West Africa. You are engaged in an act of interaction with somebody thousands of miles away under entirely different life circumstances through a chain of flows of information that are triggered by the act of purchase. And that's what I think many people think of as the magic of the market. The implication of this way of looking at how markets work, the implication is twofold. First, what's called consumer sovereignty, and second, what we will call allocative efficiency. Let me mention what consumer sovereignty means. In this story about how markets work and how all this coordination takes place, the key actors are not the producers. The key actor is the consumer. It's the preferences and behaviors of consumers which drive the system. It's your decision to buy the chocolate bar or someone's decision to build the house in Madison. You get socially optimal results by each separate person simply pursuing interests without any planner or authority, acting on their preferences. The individuals may be very selfish and self-centered, but the outcome is socially optimal because it provides for this massive levels of coordination. And it's the preferences of the people who consume the stuff which drives the system. The term consumer sovereignty means the consumers are really in power. In this way of looking at things, in this very simplified story, multinational corporations don't really have any power. Sony Corporation is simply doing the bidding of consumers. And if consumers decide they don't like the products, too bad for the multinational corporation. It's the consumer that drives the system, because it's the consumer who is not being forced to buy anything who does the buying, and it's the buying which sets in motion this chain of signals. So consumer sovereignty is one of the consequences of this view of how markets work. And there is some real truth in this. So I will be critical of the notion of consumer sovereignty, as you'll see. I'll argue why I think it's an overstated idea, because consumers can be manipulated, for example. But nevertheless, there is a kernel of real truth in it, and it is one of the virtues of the market. The second idea that follows from this supply and demand and equilibrium kind of process, the second key idea is the notion of allocative efficiency. Allocative efficiency. Allocate means to decide how different resources are going to be used and how they're going to be distributed. And allocative efficiency means that you have allocated all the resources in the most efficient possible way. What exactly does allocative efficiency mean? Now, to explain this, I have to introduce a technical concept, which I think is, I've debated whether or not I should stop doing this. You know, I teach this course every other year. This concept gives lots of people trouble. You know, I know that a lot of you are going to have trouble really understanding this idea, Pareto optimality. But it is an important idea, and I think it's worth making it as clear as possible. So for better or worse, I'm going to subject you to it again this year. The term Pareto, that is the name of an Italian, 19th century Italian economist, Vilfredo Pareto. Economists like to name their concepts after the first person who used it. So this particular idea of efficiency is called Pareto optimality because of a guy named Pareto. So don't worry about the word Pareto, it's just a person's name. Let me explain what's going on here. Let me give you an example, and then I will explain it technically. So here's an example. There's roughly 200 people in this class. It looks a little less today, but more or less. Let us suppose I came to class with a bag of fruit, and I randomly gave some of you apples and some of you oranges. So everybody gets one fruit, but some of you get apples and some of you get oranges. And I say nobody is allowed to trade. You can't exchange these fruit. You just have to live with the fruit you got. And then somebody says, that's ridiculous. I hate oranges. And somebody else says, that's ridiculous. I hate apples. And I say, all right. You can exchange your fruit if you want to. So some apple owners exchange them for oranges. It's always voluntary. Every exchange means that there's an improvement in the allocative efficiency. We move to a better situation after every trade because somebody's been made better off and nobody's been made worse off, right? Every trade results in improvement. At some point, nobody wants to trade anymore. So everybody has traded as much as they can. And it turns out that there's some people who are stuck with apples who really wanted an orange, but there is nobody at that point who has an orange who wants an apple. At that point, any subsequent trade would make somebody worse off, even if it also made somebody better off. If the apple hater managed to switch with the orange lover, the apple hater would be better off, but the orange lover would be worse off. So the idea here then is you begin with an initial distribution. Some people have apples, some people have oranges. And then if you allow people to trade, the result is improvement. Lives are more satisfied because you've allowed people to exchange their apples for oranges. Once you reach the point where no further trades are possible, once you've reached the point where there's nobody that could be made better off without somebody being made worse off, once you reach that point, then you're at the point that's called Pareto optimality. So now let me give you the specific bits of the definition. First, optimality is the best possible outcome of a process. That's a general term. You can talk about the optimal amount of time to train for a race. So it's the best amount of time possible, which is not necessarily the maximum. For those of you who are athletes, you know well that the maximum amount of time you can train for a race may not be the optimal amount of time, because you may actually damage yourself if you overtrain. So the optimality means the best possible amount of time that you can train, or the best possible outcome of any process. Pareto optimality, then, is a distribution of things such that no one can be made better off without someone being made worse off. No one can be better off without someone being worse off. That is Pareto optimality. Pareto suboptimality is a situation in which, by redistributing things, at least one person could be made better off without anyone being worse off. So we are at a suboptimal distribution, Pareto suboptimal, if at least one person could be made better off without anybody being made worse off. Now, nobody would object. It'd be sort of mean, right, to object to changing a distribution that makes someone better off if no one is harmed. And that's what makes the idea of Pareto optimality attractive. You keep changing, you keep distributing, you keep exchanging until no one can be made better off without somebody else being harmed. And then here's the basic claim about markets. So this brings these things all together. The basic claim about markets is that if you have free markets and allow people to exchange and produce for the market and do all these voluntary dispersed exchanges, you end up with a Pareto optimal distribution of things that have been exchanged on the market. Markets are efficient in this sense. This is allocative efficiency. If you allow the markets to just rip, let them go without any restrictions, at some point they reach a state where nobody can be made better off without somebody being made worse off. And that's called allocative efficiency. It's actually a pretty peculiar kind of efficiency. Go back to my example of the apples and oranges in the class. Suppose I gave some of you 10 apples and I give some people 5 apples and 5 oranges, and others of you I give 1 apple and others 1 orange. And then I say trade as much as you want. Eventually you'll reach a Pareto optimal distribution. But do we really want to say the distribution is efficient? Because the initial allocations were kind of weird. Some people had much more flexibility in how they could trade than others. Some people had more resources to begin with. So the allocative efficiency of markets is completely silent about the starting conditions. It says nothing about how efficient the initial distribution is. It just simply says whatever that distribution is, you allow people to trade, you'll reach Pareto optimality, and we will call that allocative efficiency. And that's one of the virtues of a market. That's one of the defenses of a market. One of the pragmatic defenses of a market is allocative efficiency. The distributions of things will be Pareto optimal if you allow people to trade as much as they want. There's a second kind of efficiency, which is also important. This is called dynamic efficiency. Allocative efficiency just means, given what we have, is it distributed efficiently? Dynamic efficiency refers to the ways in which markets create growth dynamically. Dynamic means change over time. Markets create incentives for people to take risks. This is the kind of classic story. You've all heard this story. It gets repeated in political speeches all the time. Innovators take risks with unproven inventions or by investing time and energy in research and development that may not succeed. When you try to invent something, you're taking a risk because you're devoting your time and energy and resources, and it may not pan out. Most people fail in this risk-taking activity. But if you succeed, there's a big payoff. The idea here is basically like a lottery or a casino. If you take a gamble and you get the payoff if you win. And therefore, you have an incentive to gamble. You have an incentive to gamble so long as there's a big payoff if you win. That means taking risks. This seems okay so long as other people aren't hurt by your risk-taking activity. It seems fine, in principle, that a person should gain the benefits of taking risks so long as engaging in risks isn't hurting other people. We'll talk about this in subsequent lectures. It's one of the problems in the idea of dynamic efficiency of markets. One of the problems is that lots of people turn out to get hurt by other people's risk-taking activity. And therefore, if you take a lot of risks and you reap all the rewards, but if you lose, other people get hurt, well, that doesn't seem efficient. That is, it's not a balancing of costs and benefits in an efficient way. And we'll explore that. Nevertheless, one of the virtues of markets is the way that it organizes risk-taking in a systematic manner that does indeed lead to innovation and produces growth because of the payoffs that people get to risk. One final set of arguments about the market. So again, just to remind you, this first lecture is the market, how it's supposed to work, and the arguments in defense of the market. What I want to focus on here, and this we will again talk about in much greater depth in subsequent lectures, is the two core arguments against the state interference with the market. Again, there's a moral and a pragmatic argument. The moral argument is that state regulation is itself an affront to freedom because the state prevents you from doing things. State coercion inherently reduces freedom, and therefore limited government rather than an affirmative state is consistent with the ideal of freedom. Governments rule by command backed by force. That's what governments do. Governments are therefore inherently a threat to freedom. This is inherent. It doesn't have to do with the intentions of the government. The sheer fact of the state implies restrictions on freedom. This doesn't mean that government should be abolished. Most advocates of unfettered free markets are not anarchists. That is, they don't want a world without government. But they believe the government should be strictly circumscribed, and the burden of proof is always on those who say the government should do something. The state should be what is sometimes called a night watchman state rather than an affirmative state. The state should maintain stable rules of the game. It should enforce property rights, but it should not interfere with the functioning of markets. This is the libertarian perspective on government, limited government. Government should guarantee that people will be rewarded for their acquisitiveness and their selfishness, but should not interfere with voluntary exchanges. That is the moral argument for a free market freed from government regulation. The pragmatic argument centers around the notion of state incompetence and what might be called state malevolence. State incompetence means that the unintended negative effects of government intervention are always pervasive. Governments always muck up things. All thumbs, no fingers. This is not a moral argument. This says, this doesn't say that the state wouldn't be justified in interfering in the market. It just says it's incapable of doing it. Every effort at regulation becomes bureaucratic red tape. Every effort at controlling pollution simply thwarts investment. That governments are heavy-handed and they can't do a good job of it. That's the government incompetence argument. The second pragmatic argument against an affirmative state, that is a state that does systematically try to interfere in the market to regulate it, the second one centers around what could be called state malevolence. You can also, if you want a catchy phrase, you can call this the Frankenstein problem. Building up a state to do good things means creating a state machinery that has power. But the bureaucrats who are actually in control of that power will always act in their own interests rather than the interests of society. And furthermore, as soon as you create a powerful state, it will get captured by powerful actors outside of the state who will use it for their own purposes. This isn't the same as the incompetence argument. This is saying that if you create centers of power, the power will be captured and used for purposes other than the beneficial regulation of markets. In this Frankenstein problem, it's better not to have a state that could regulate the economy than to create a powerful enough state to regulate the economy, because if it's powerful enough to regulate the economy, then it will get captured by private interests or by bureaucrats who will use it for other purposes. And the monster cannot be controlled. That's a pragmatic argument, though. It's not the same as the libertarian argument, the moral argument. It's saying, the libertarian argument says, that even if state regulations improved the functioning of the market and made lives better for people, even if it did that, it would be unjustified because it's a violation of freedom, and freedom is too important to sacrifice even for the public welfare. That's the moral argument. The moral argument is that intrinsically state action violates freedom. The pragmatic argument says what's wrong with state intervention is that it always mucks it up, incompetence, or it uses it for bad purposes, malevolence. Okay, that's the account of the arguments in favor of the market, the defense of the market. In the next class, we will begin discussing the problems with this defense. See you on Thursday.